So welcome to today's Dhamma talk, and on a series of talks for this meditation retreat, now we're coming to the interesting stuff, enlightenment, Nibbana. I'm going to start off with a story from my life. Because when I was a young man, I was always interested in religions. And at that time, obviously being brought up in England, in London, sometimes when I started to talk about religion, we always came up with the idea of a God, a supreme being. And I really wanted to find out, if I'm going to believe in Christianity or a religion which had a supreme being at its heart, I wanted to know what God was. So I went to the priest, the chaplain of the school where I studied, and I asked, well, what is God anyway? And he replied, like God is like ineffable, ungraspable, like the ground of all being. So if you think about it, you can't grasp it. So it's beyond explanation. It transcends all words. And when he started talking like that, I thought, the guy doesn't know what he's talking about. If he knew what God was, he'd give a simple answer instead of all his words like the ground of all being, beyond comprehension, all that sort of stuff. And that was one of the reasons why I gave up Christianity, simply because no one could actually explain to me, you know, what God really was. But then after a while, when I became a Buddhist and I started going around and listening to monks giving talks, so one day I asked the monk, he said, this enlightenment, this Nibbana, what is it? And he replied, oh, it's ineffable. It's like the ground of all being. It's beyond words. It's transcendent. Now, I've heard that before. And again, I didn't believe him. Because it's something which I always had in the bottom of my heart. Some idea that if a person really understood what they were talking about, they'd be able to say in simple words, which everybody could understand. At least, you know, it'd be something you could actually hold on to and find some idea of what these things really are. A lot of times when people say all these mystical things, it sounds good, but really what they're saying is, I don't know. So today, I'm not going to say anything mystical. I'm going to say things which are really down to earth. So you, whether you like it or not, you might not agree with this, but today I'm going to tell you what enlightenment is. So at least you know what you're doing here. I should have really given this talk first of all, so you know what you're in for. Do you really want to become enlightened? First of all, you've got to know what enlightenment is. Do you really want this? I think it's a bit late now for many of you. You're already on the path, so you're going to start with this anyway. So enlightenment, exactly what it is. One of the best similes for enlightenment, I can start off with this old simile first of all. Some of you have heard this before, actually many of you have heard this before. It's probably the most easy to understand simile, but also the most profound simile for enlightenment, which actually shows you just how you can explain things in very simple terms. And it's the story of the wishing game. Some of you know that one before. I'm going to repeat it at full, because some of you may not have heard this. There were five children playing the wishing game. And the wishing game works like this. If you had a wish, what would it be? And the child who came up with the best wish would win the wishing game. So the first child was asked, if you had a wish, what would it be? And the first child thought a little bit and said, if I had a wish, I would wish for an ice cream. It was a hot day and he liked ice creams. Very good. They asked the second young girl, if you had a wish, what would it be? Now perhaps it was because she had more chance and more time to think. But she came up with a wish, if I had a wish, I'd wish for an ice cream factory. Then I won't have just one ice cream, I'll have as many ice creams as I ever want, every day of my life if I want it. And I can also give some ice cream to my friends. And the child who only got one ice cream, he thought himself so stupid, he knew he'd lost. and the girl with the whole ice cream factory was sure to do better. So then they asked the third child, if you had a wish, what would it be? And this young boy, again, had been thinking and said, if I had a wish, I would wish for $1 billion. US, of course. With $1 billion, with $1 billion, I could buy my own ice cream factory, and I could also buy my own McDonald's. I could have a hamburger and fries, and my mother can never tell me no. Then I'll buy my own video game store. Fourthly, I'll buy my own school. Because if I own a school, I can give myself top marks without even having to go. And I can spend all my time playing video games. Then I'll buy my own university and give myself a degree. Because with $1 billion US, you can do whatever you want. And when he said, when I think of something else, then I'll buy that. $1 billion US is enough to last you your whole life. So the child who only got an ice cream factory thought, how stupid I am. And how clever is that boy with the $1 billion wish. So then they asked the fourth child, this young girl. And she had been thinking, and she was very smart. She outdid the $1 billion wish. Because she said, if I had a wish, I would wish for 3 wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish, I'd have the ice cream factory. For my second wish, I'd have the $1 billion US. And for my third wish, I'd have 3 more wishes. That way, I could keep going on forever. Beat that. And the other 3 children, even the child with the $1 billion wish, thought, my goodness, that is a genius. An unlimited amount of wishes. Surely no one can beat that. But there was 1 child left. And this last child managed to have a wish which clearly beat and did much better than a child who had an infinity of wishes. That child said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes. I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes. And even the little girl who had an infinity of wishes thought, you win. That child won the wishing game. Contentment so you don't need any more wishes is better than always needing another wish coming next. The last child is the Buddha. And contentment, when you don't need any more wishes, is what enlightenment is. So content, you never need anything ever again. The end of craving, the end of desire. So content, you don't need any more wishes. What a beautiful description that is of enlightenment, of nirvana. Something each one of you can understand. And so beautifully put in a little story, which is so simple, which shows how little craving gets more and more and more. And it meets the limit of craving, what some people think is the highest happiness in this world, to be so rich and so powerful that you can get whatever you want, whenever you want it. Sometimes we call that the freedom of desire. That's the hope of wealthy and powerful people, having an infinity of wishes. Whenever I want it, and it comes. However, even better than that is the contentment, so you don't need any wishes to begin with. Nirvana. So, if contentment is nirvana, how do we get there? And I think I've already been talking to you for the last 7 or 8 days how to be content. How to have no more wishes. Now you may have been that child who said, if I have a wish, I wish for jhana. Well, I wish for at least a vimitta. I've only got 1 day left. Now you're like those child at the beginning. You'll never find nirvana that way. Your wish, your aspiration, of all the next meditations, I hope I'm so content that I don't even have any more desires and no wishes. I don't even want a nimitta, I don't want jhanas, I don't want insight. I wish I'm so content I don't need any of that. And then you know not only what Nibbana is, but the path to Nibbana. The trouble is, it's so hard to be content. It's so, so hard for you to let go. Even though you've got so much, each one of you, you wonder, what more do I need to be content? However, there's something inside of us which is always moving, grabbing on, doing things. And I've pointed that out in this whole retreat, this dua. And yesterday, and the day before, I pointed out where this doing comes from. Where it all arises from. If you ever look at sort of classical Buddhism, dependent origination, that particular craving is sometimes called the karma formations, the willing formations. And that's the second factor of dependent origination. It arises from delusion. The delusion that is a self here, doing things. All that doing, that lack of contentment, always arises from this delusion of a self, a me. A couple of days ago, was it yesterday, I gave the simile of the driverless bus. When you find there's nobody in here, there's complete emptiness, the illusion of a me and a mind is shattered. And once you see that, you go back to your seat in the bus, in this metaphor, and you stop asking for things, you stop complaining, you stop wishing. You're content, because there's no one to complain to. Everything is going according to cause and effect, it's actually quite perfect. Even many people, actually I've told you in your interviews, I say your meditation retreat has been absolutely perfect. It could not have been better. It couldn't have been worse either. it's what happens. However, because we have this illusion of a me and a mind, a self, this is the main reason why we lack contentment. And so the Buddha saw the path to enlightenment. In order to gain that contentment, so you feel so free and at ease, you don't want anything anymore, we have to find out this self business. And that has always been the path to enlightenment. To actually to see that emptiness, to see that non-self, to see there's nobody in here. And this is why we have to meditate, why we have to do this path of stillness and jhanas, actually to see this. Without those jhanas, you just don't see non-self. The trouble is with the self, the doer, is that when we stop doing things, and I mentioned this in the interviews, when we stop doing things, it's as if we die. It's actually one of the definitions of a dead thing, a dead body. If you see somebody who is, you know, lying down there, you see if they're doing anything, if they're breathing, or if you've got a pulse, or you poke them to see if they say, ow. If they don't do anything, that's a pretty good sign, they're dead. Or if it's like an inanimate object, like that gong, does it do anything? You know, you touch it, does it speak back, leave me alone? If it doesn't respond, if it doesn't do anything, it's dead, it hasn't got existence. Which is why you can actually see that doing something affirms your existence. And when you become very, very still, when you don't do anything, it's as if you disappear. When you get into deep meditation, it's like you're dying. Something in you, the doer, the will, is disappearing. Which is why my teacher, Ajahn Chah, the first year I was in Thailand with him, he had this saying he would keep asking you again and again and again. It was like the fashion for that year. Ajahn Chah would come up to you and said, have you come to this monastery to die? Have you come here to die? Have you come here to die? And of course, when a great master like that says these little sayings, they're very meaningful. No, I've come here to live. No, have you come here to die? This little self, the me, has that come here to die? In other words, are you able to let go? Because letting go is like dying. That's why, I've mentioned in an interview, it was actually a saying of Jean-Paul Sartre, the French philosopher. who, as he said, to be means to do. To be is to do. If you don't do anything, it's like you're not being at all. To be is to do. And that was a refinement of Descartes. You know, Descartes, I think, therefore I am. That was also, he said, that thinking is doing. So to do is to be. That was Descartes. To do is to be. Jean-Paul Sartre said the opposite. To be is to do. And the whole lot was summed up by the modern American philosopher Frank Sinatra, who said, do be do be do. Now whenever you give a very deep talk, you have to crack a joke now and again to keep people awake. And that actually, that particular joke, I actually saw as a student, it was scrawled as graffiti on the philosophy department in Cambridge, on the walls. There it was, sort of, to do is to be, René Descartes. To be is to do, Jean-Paul Sartre. And underneath, dooby-dooby-doo, Frank Sinatra. And later on, it's amazing how this cause and effects, because I mentioned that in quite a few talks, just to make people laugh, but also to give a very deep understanding of the connection between being and doing, between craving and wanting and existence. That somebody once went into one of these greeting card shops and they found that was actually being put on a greeting card. And they sent it to me. It was just like the joke on one of these funny greeting cards. But they had no acknowledgement at all. It came from Ajahn Brahm. I was very disappointed. But nevertheless, when you understand that when there's an existence there, there's a doing, you understand that why one has to see this non-self before you can be content. As long as you think you are there, you'll always be doing something. One of what I thought was my similes when I started teaching like this was a simile of a hand. A hand always tends to pick up things. I think I gave a simile a few days ago, I'm not sure. Because it was like when I was a young monk, I think I did give it here a few days ago. You gave up sex and girls because you were celibate, and then you kept on eating too much food. You were attaching, you were grasping food. You gave up food, you were grasping something else. You were grasping cups of tea or sleeping or whatever. It seems that when you try and detach, give up your attachments, you give up one thing, you pick up another one. You give up that one and you get attached to something else. You're always grasping. And I understood later on, you will always grasp if you have an ego, a sense of self. Because that's what the sense of self does. It grasps, it craves, it attaches. That's its function. In the same way, the function of a hand is to pick things up. As long as you've got a hand, you'll be picking things up. You'll be grasping, you'll be attaching, because that's what a hand does. And when I started this simile, I said, look, the only way to cut off attachments, to be free, to attain nirvana, is to cut off your hand, to cut off the sense of self. And I thought that was an original Ajahn Brahm simile. Until one day, I was reading the suttas, and the simile of the hand, just as I said it, is in the Sanyutta Nikaya taught by the Buddha himself. And that really spooked me. That was, whoo! Did I really invent that, or is it coming from some past life? And I heard that simile, because it came from the Buddha. So the point is, to let go of craving and attachment, one has to see non-self. To see there's nobody in there. That is the defining moment, that insight into non-self, into the life of a Buddhist. That sets you on the path to nirvana. That is the attainment of stream winning. The stages of enlightenment, as many of you know, are four. The stream winner, the once returner, the non-returner, and the arahat. The stream winner is someone who's seen non-self, who's seen the Dhamma, who's seen what the Buddha saw, who's seen the emptiness. You've seen the source, the emptiness in that middle of the lotus. Once that happens, you're called Arya, you're a noble one. Once you've seen that, there's no turning back, seven lifetimes at most, and then you'll be fully enlightened. As you practice more, and that insight gets more and more, it does its work on your habits, on the way you think and the way you perceive. You let go more and more, once you cut off the sense of self, you let go more and more, letting go becomes easy. You get to that stage of just renunciation, of letting go of attachments, of no craving, so you only come back once to this world. It's called a once-returner. If you let go even more, you become a non-returner, go into the pure abodes, and there you attain nirvana. Or you let go so much, even in this life, you become fully attained, arahat. No more craving, no more wishing. You've done your job. At the end of your life, you'll be fully enlightened. Those are the four stages of enlightenment. To make it very clear, the Buddha gave a beautiful simile of the seven shipwrecked sailors. The seven shipwrecked sailors simile is actually a favorite of the King of Thailand. And that's actually where I first heard it, and later saw it straight in the suttas. The seven shipwrecked sailors simile goes like this. There was a ship sailing the oceans, it sort of foundered or had a hole and it sank, and there were seven survivors. The first shipwrecked sailor, he was in the water there, he floated for a little while, couldn't really last, and he went straight down and drowned. Shipwrecked sailor number one. Up for a little while and then goes down. Shipwrecked sailor number two. He's also floating, he floats a bit longer, then he goes down, then he goes up, then he goes down, then he goes up. Always bobbing up and down until he finally goes down. The third shipwrecked sailor is one who floats on the surface. He can actually swim and tread water. So the third shipwrecked sailor never goes down, he's actually floating above the surface. The fourth shipwrecked sailor is almost like a subset of the third shipwrecked sailor. It's a sailor who floats on the surface, he doesn't go down, but this sailor, floating on the surface, looks around and sees dry land. He sees solid land in the distance. So the fourth shipwrecked sailor, who's one who sees dry land. The fifth shipwrecked sailor, again, is the one who's floated, seen dry land, and now he's swimming towards the dry land. So the fifth shipwrecked sailor is the one who's on his way to safety, swimming towards dry land. The sixth shipwrecked sailor, he's been swimming to the dry land for a long time now. He's so close, he does not need to swim anymore. He stands up, there's solid ground underneath him. He's wading through the surf to the shore. He's actually walking now. He's that close to dry land. That's the sixth shipwrecked sailor. And the last shipwrecked sailor, number seven, he's made it to dry land, and he's sitting under a nice coconut tree with a bowl of noodles, having a wonderful time. He's made it, he's safe. Now in the suttas, that's actually how it read in the suttas, except they didn't mention the bowl of noodles. Not in the suttas. However, in the suttas, the Buddha said that is a simile for people on the path to enlightenment. The first shipwrecked sailor is a person who does a tiny bit of good karma, which is why he floats, but he's got so much bad karma he goes straight down. The second shipwrecked sailor is just the ordinary person. They've got some good karma, some bad karma, they go up and down, up and down. The third shipwrecked sailor is the one who's got good karma, who's got lots of merit, who's kept precepts, who's given generously, who is a compassionate person, done lots of service, meditated or whatever. Because of their good karma, they float on the surface. They always seem to be above life's troubles and difficulties. They're always like survivors. They're at peace. They can cope. They're always floating on the surface. The fourth shipwrecked sailor, a person with such good karma, they're always above things, they never get too overwhelmed by life's difficulties, they have time to look around. And when they have time to look around, they see dry land. That's a meditator who, because they've got good karma, they've got a bit of freedom to meditate and practice, they get the insight. They see the far shore, safety, nirvana. They see what nirvana is. The fourth shipwrecked sailor is the stream winner. They see where safety lies. The fifth shipwrecked sailor, the one having seen dry land, having seen the Dharma, having seen safety, is now swimming. They're on the way to get there. So that's the once returner. They haven't reached the goal yet, but they're on their way. And the sixth shipwrecked sailor, they swam so far, they're so close to the goal, they can stand in the surf, and they just wave to shore. That's the non-returner. The third stage of enlightenment. The non-returner is so close to Nibbana, it's hardly any difference there at all. And the last shipwrecked sailor, they're on the shore, sitting under the tree, eating their noodles. That's the anagami. They're free, they're happy, they've made it, they're enlightened. The seventh shipwrecked sailor. So this is a story of the Buddha which actually tells you actually what enlightenment actually is, it's a process. The crucial thing is actually seeing safety, seeing the far shore, seeing the end of suffering, seeing where real freedom lies. I already mentioned it's not the freedom of desire. You're trying to get more and more things in your life, or trying to achieve, or trying to be this control freak, trying to be someone. If you want to get deep meditation, you can get it. That's not what this is about. Not desire and achieving your desires. It's the being free of desires. That's the far shore. That's safety. So all of you who've been trying to meditate, trying to get somewhere, you think that, oh, because I've got the present moment awareness, because I've been able to watch the breath for hours, or because I've been able to see a nimitta, or because I've been able to get into a jhana even, you think you're so good. No. The whole purpose of this retreat is to have no desires at all. Not to want anything. Not to want nimittas, not to want jhanas. If you're someone who sits in here and says, I'm content no matter what happens, if jhanas come fine, if they don't come fine, it's all the same to me, then you are getting close to Nibbana. Now do you understand where your mistake has been? You've been trying to get somewhere, whereas Nibbana is just being here. No desires, not craving, not trying to get somewhere, but full contentment. Now when a person makes his full contentment, really full contentment, then they may see non-self. There's no one in here anyway, so why are you struggling so hard? And it's doing the struggling anyway. It's illusion doing the struggling. Stupidity. That's why we struggle so hard. When you realize you don't have to. It's a great freedom to realize you don't have to struggle in life. You don't have to please other people. You don't have to please yourself. You don't even have to please me. You don't, certainly don't have to please the Buddha. The Buddha is already pleased no matter who you are. It's called ultimate compassion. So what are you trying to prove in this meditation? What are you trying to get to? What are you trying to make happen in this meditation retreat? Isn't it about time you really let go and stop trying to please anybody, just completely abandon and let go and renounce and become completely content and don't try and get anywhere, but just try and be and allow yourself to have the freedom of desires coming from the emptiness of the self. When you can do that, something happens. You see just how easy this is. There's a picture of my teacher Ajahn Chah, one of the favourite pictures we have of him. He was visiting England at the time. He only went there once, and eventually we started a monastery over there. And there's a picture of him in the back of this little centre in Hampstead with his hands up like this, with a big smile on his face. It was imitating a statue, which is, I think, in Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery in the south of Thailand, with the caption, "Joy at last to know there's no happiness in the world. Joy at last to know there's no happiness in the world." It sounds like a Zen koan. I've already mentioned there's no difference between Zen and Theravada Buddhism and Vajrayana. It's all the same. We all have our fascinating and deep teachings. Happiness at last to know there's no joy in the world. Or joy at last to know there's no happiness in the world. The same really. What it really means is joy at last to know that all the striving will never get you anywhere. Because you think that somehow if you strive, if you struggle, if you work hard enough, I'm talking about in meditation, not talking about in your business.
People keep on telling me that. I say, well, if we all did that, what would happen? I said, yes, yes, but this is meditation. This little area here, the way of enlightenment. So if you just didn't strive, you have all the joy you wanted. And the reason you don't strive is whatever you do in your meditation, you're always going to miss the point. You'll never find happiness. So, knowing there's no happiness in your meditation, joy at last to realize I can just let go and just be still and be peaceful. That's one of Ajahn Chah's little favorite sayings. Joy at last. To know there's no happiness in the world. So it means you have to let go. You've got no choice. If something happens when you let go and you see this, I've been talking about this all the retreat, and one day the penny will drop. You start to see where I'm pointing, to start to see that emptiness inside. Start to see that when you stop, then you're free. When you give up desires, then you have everything you ever want. When you stop traveling on the journey, then you find you've arrived. This is actually how we get the first stage of enlightenment. We stop traveling. We find all this time we've been here. The famous Zen saying, the hungry farmer was looking for fire with a lighted lantern so he could start the fire to cook his food. If he only knew what fire was, he was looking with a lighted lantern, he would have cooked his rice much quicker. You are looking for nirvana, like a person looking for a flame. You've already got a lighted lantern. If you could only look at the right place, you'd be able to become enlightened much quicker. You'd be able to cook your dinner much earlier. So this is what we really mean. If you stop looking outside and look inside, if you stop craving for happiness somewhere else and find it in this moment, if you stop doing things and just be, if you just stop, if you build up contentment, then you have this beautiful experience called stream winning. I've already mentioned, I think yesterday, that or the day before, there were two causes, two important conditions, two keys which come together for the attainment of stream winning. One of them is the words of another, the teachings. And I've been giving you those teachings for the last 6 or 7 days, heaps of them, all pointing in the same direction. From this way, that way, each and every way, from up and down, always pointing in the same direction. You've had heaps of paratagosa, the words of another. The second thing which you need is this yoni samanasikara, the work of the mind which goes to the source, which goes to the origin, which goes to this moment, which goes to the source of this craving or this delusion. Right in the center of this moment, you'll find the emptiness of self. That's what you have to do. The Buddha's point the way. They can give the words, but now you have to try it out. Try a few moments of desirelessness, utter contentment, stillness, not wanting, real contentment, freedom, emptiness, not doing anything, so you don't feel that you are. To do is to be. When you stop doing, being stops too. Emptiness. So one gets this incredible experience of emptiness, non-self. That experience, when it first comes, blows you apart. It's like an explosion happens in the mind. An explosion which leaves you stunned, full of bliss, happy as anything, thinking you're enlightened. This is one of the problems with enlightenment. Whenever you have a deep insight like this, all the deep insights make you feel like you're enlightened. Trouble is, you have to wait for a while, and after a while, as it were, when the dust settles, then you can see what defilements are left standing. To give you an example, I'm now going to tell you the story of when I became enlightened. Do you want to hear this? Some of you have heard this before. I was 4 years as a monk in Thailand, and my meditation was getting very hot in this forest monastery. had lots of time for sitting and walking, because I was this wonderful age, 4 years as a monk. You weren't in the abbey, you had no responsibilities, you didn't have to give any teachings, but you weren't that junior, you didn't have to do all these chores. You had this great moment in your monastic life, those middle years, where you could have lots of time to meditate. And you were comfortable, you knew all the rules, you knew what to do. So it was a very comfortable and powerful time. And one evening during the rains retreat, this period of 3 months during the monsoon, when you have nothing else to do but sit and walk all day, I was walking meditation one evening. My mind was already quite peaceful. And then the mind got so peaceful and all these amazing insights started coming. When insights come, you just can't stop them. You don't have to look for them. They come flooding into you. And they came flooding like a cascade of incredible understanding until the big one came. The big insight. Wow, that was amazing. You just can't imagine what it feels like to be enlightened. At last, after all that time, you are free of all your hindrances, all your desires and cravings. Oh, it's amazing. Just so much happiness. Joy at last, and there's no happiness in the world. The trouble was, it didn't last that long, because I wasn't really enlightened. That's what I tell the story. If it really was true, I wouldn't be able to say it, because we can't make those claims in public. But I tell this story because it's funny, and also it shows us how easy it is to get fooled. But to me, it sounded like it was a real thing. All the signs were there. It was so easy. You didn't have any trouble of meditating. Even though it was late at night, your mind was just so peaceful, so still. And I did go back to my room to lay down, but as many of you know, when you get into deep meditation, you can't sleep. You just lay down there, just so still and peaceful. In this monastery, you had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. That's when the bell went. It was monsoon, really humid and hot, lots of mosquitoes. And nearly every morning, when you went to this morning chanting at 3 o'clock, you're always nodding and sleepy. It was, now, the nature of the place was just so hot. But this morning, I didn't even wait till 3 o'clock. I was there by about 2:15. I was just sitting there, perfect posture. No sloth and torpor at all. You don't need to try. You just sit there, straight in this beautiful, peaceful breath. There's huge amounts of bliss. Oh, it is so wonderful. The sitting meditation like that, you don't even need to start. You sit down, it's already there. Ah, oh, it's so wonderful being enlightened. And when you did the chanting, you had all this energy. There's no sort of all this energy, and you're so bright and happy. And then after the chanting and the meditation, you went on the alms round in the morning, and I was giving all this amazing loving kindness to all these donors, you know, because they've been feeding me all this time, and I thought, now you can give food to an enlightened monk, may you be happy and well, may you be blissed out. And I was really getting into it. Now, what happened? I need to sort of give you a bit of background. In the northeast Thailand about 30 years ago, maybe 27 years ago, in northeast Thailand, the food was disgusting. The fact that Western monks could eat that stuff was a miracle in itself. Because there was no... I was a vegetarian before I became a monk, and had to give up becoming a vegetarian, because there was no vegetables in that part of Thailand at the time. What you ate was rice, sticky rice, and whatever crawled. Frogs, snails, bats, what was the other thing we used to have? Oh, the old crickets, ant eggs, and ants as well, red ant soup. Had the afterbirth of the water buffalo, that was very common. Gross food. And to show how gross it was, one of the stories that one day, we only had one meal of the day, there's no breakfast or anything like that, just one meal. All we had was the board of sticky rice and one frog, like a big toad on top. And it wasn't fried, it didn't have any sort of seasoning, it was just boiled frog, with not even any salt of anything. And that's all you had to eat that day, a bowl of rice and a boiled frog. And that had to keep you going for the next 24 hours. There's no fruit, no sweets or anything, no bananas or nothing, just that's all, nothing else. One frog each and a bowl of rice. So, like everybody else, you start picking at the legs of the frog, because the frog's legs, that's like chicken, it's just meat. You can eat that stuff, but there's not much meat on the frog's legs. And you need something to sustain yourself. So the next thing, you start picking at the insides of the frog. The monk sitting next to me, who didn't know much about biology to start with, pressed the frog's bladder. The bladder had urine in it. And so this frog peed all over his rice. That's a true story. Even though he was hungry, he couldn't keep eating after that. That was it. He went hungry instead. Now that was a sort of food, but the staple was what was called rotten fish. The rotten fish literally was rotten fish, pladesh it was called. What they would do, because it was subsistence, it was a very poor area, they would catch the fish in the paddy fields during the wet season. And they would obviously eat them fresh during the monsoon season, but after catching the fish, they would have to store some for the rest of the year. And they really didn't know how to pickle those fish. So very often they just shove them in a jar, maybe a tiny bit of salt, and cover them with a bit of plastic and elastic band and leave them to rot. To tell you what it was like, one day when I was doing my chores around the monastery, I was cleaning up around the kitchen and I found one of the jars with the rotten fish in it. The plastic covering the entrance to the jar had been perforated and the whole jar was crawling with maggots. And so I picked it up to throw it away. As it happened, the head man of the village was in the monastery at that time. Now the head man was the most educated and the most refined of all those Thai villagers. When he saw me about to throw this maggot-infested rotten fish away, he said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Look, it's got maggots in it." He said, "Stop, that's more protein, give it to me." And next day we had rotten fish curry. And that's all you had. So that was the staple. Even at the beginning of the rains retreat, when this happened, we were still having rotten fish curry. They hadn't started giving us the fresh fish yet. They hadn't really grown, spawned and grown big in the paddy fields yet. And it really stank, the rotten fish curry. It tasted awful, terrible smell, but that's all you had. So most days you'd have your bowl of rice and a scoop of rotten fish curry. This one day, after my enlightenment, I couldn't believe it. There were two pots of curry waiting for us. One was the normal rotten fish curry, and the other one was the delicious smelling pork curry. I don't know where they got that pork from, but it actually smelled, you know, like edible, something you could eat. And I thought straight away, I know, the Devas have come to celebrate my enlightenment. They've got this beautiful pork curry for me. And I said, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Because even the Devas are very happy when someone becomes enlightened. So I thought, this is marvellous. Not only am I enlightened, but I'm going to get a good meal today. So as this situation was, the once we came down to the meal, the abbot, who was just above me, I was number two monk, he took his meal first of all. So he had the two pots of curry. After giving the blessing, he took out these three whopping big spoonfuls of the pork curry. Amazing just how greedy he was. I mean, they were really big, you know, sort of ladles. But I thought, I didn't really matter because there's plenty left for me and it's coming back to me next. They never took any of the rotten fish curry. They just took 3 big ladles of the pork curry, and then he lifted up the pot of pork curry and then started pouring it in the rotten fish curry, saying, "It's all the same anyway, it's all the same anyway." And I thought, how can he say this? Having taken out his own, first of all, if it was all the same, he should have actually mixed it up before he took his own. And he took out his big, whopping ladlefuls, and now he'd mixed up the pork with the rotten fish. I would miss my meal. I wasn't going to stand this. I was angry at this hypocrite, this glutton, this greedy abbot. And then I had an insight. Enlightened beings don't get angry like this. I thought, oh no. I realized at that point I wasn't enlightened after all. And however high you were thinking you were enlightened, that's how far you drop into depression. And I was so fed up. From that point on, I didn't care what I ate. I thought I was enlightened, but my anger had shown me I wasn't. So I just slopped whatever it was in that pot into my bowl and just ate it. What it taught me was how easy it was to make a mistake, to think you're enlightened and you're not. And usually, if people do think they're enlightened, the acid test is always to try and make them angry and upset. Because anyone who's angry, you know you can't be fully enlightened. If you have greed, lust, you are not fully enlightened. That's just, you can't do that. All the reasons for craving, for desire, which gives rise to anger, frustration, like my hatred for that abbot, sort of, that's not there anymore. So you can always know who's enlightened and who's not by trying to make them angry. That's why the classic story is of this monk. He was a Zen monk. Actually, the story actually comes from the Chinese tradition. I think Sun Po, but we adapt it to a Zen monk these days. There was a Zen monk who was just so diligent and really wanted to become enlightened. So he was staying in this monastery somewhere in China, and he asked his abbot. Abbot said, "Look, there's a little island in the lake not far from here. Can I build myself a little hermitage? And you know, you have enough lay people here looking after us. Can one of the lay people every week row a boat over to my hermitage to give me enough food to last a week and any other things which I need? I want to really just meditate, sit and walk in absolute solitude, to completely renounce everything, to strive for full enlightenment." And the abbot was, "Okay, he was a good monk, we'll do that." So they built a simple hermitage in this isolated island in the lake, and the abbot arranged for an attendant to row over every week, once a week, to bring him like supplies of rice and pickles and whatever else, and ask him if he needed anything. And that way this monk lived a very peaceful existence for over 3 years, sitting and meditating, fully supported, having a wonderful time. But after about 3 years, he decided he was fully enlightened. And so he wanted to let his abbot know of his attainment. So one day, when the attendant came over in the boat, he asked the attendant, "Next time you come over, can you please bring these 3 things? Some expensive parchment, some ink, and a quill. I wish to write a poem in calligraphy." So the next week, the attendant came with a parchment, the ink, and a quill. And then the monk spent about 3 or 4 days meditating. When his mind was very still, when it was very inspired with the bliss of enlightenment, he wrote this poem on the parchment. The 4-line poem went like this. The diligent monk, meditating for 3 years, is no longer moved by the 4 worldly winds. The diligent monk, meditating alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the 4 worldly winds. Anyone who knows their Buddhism will know that that is an expression of full enlightenment. And he wrote it because of the power of his meditation in the most exquisite calligraphy. When he finished, he admired his work, allowed it to dry, rolled it up, tied it with a ribbon, and waited for the attendant. When the attendant came, he gave him the parchment with the instructions, "Take this to the abbot." And when the attendant rode off, the young monk started to think of all the honours he would get now he was enlightened. His parchment would probably be hung in an expensive frame in the main hall of the monastery, as we do to celebrate enlightened ones. He'd probably be appointed to this abbot of a great monastery somewhere in China. His fame would probably go throughout the land, and all the people that offered him things would get so happy to know that he was now enlightened. It felt so good to be enlightened. And he couldn't wait until the next week, when the attendant rode over, to see the response of the abbot. But all the attendant did was give him a parchment which looked just like his own, except it was wrapped in a different coloured ribbon. And the attendant said, "From the abbot." And with expectation and with joy, the young monk opened up the scroll, and he soon saw it was his own parchment, his own poem. But on the first line of his exquisite calligraphy, on the line which said, "The diligent monk," the abbot had scrawled in a red pen the four letters F-A-R-T, fart. "What is this?" thought the monk. And the next line, "Meditating alone for 3 years," this time in capital letters, F-A-R-T, fart. "What?" he said. And he looked at the third line. It's no longer moved. And this time, the letters were bigger, uglier, and had an exclamation mark after them. Fart! "He can't do this to me," thought the monk as he read the last line. "It's no longer moved by the four worldly winds." And this time over the whole line, spoiling his exquisite calligraphy, fart, with a line underneath and three exclamation marks. The monk thought, "My abbot, he can't even recognize enlightenment when it's in front of his fat nose. And moreover, he doesn't appreciate calligraphy. It took me years to get to this stage so I can write like this, and he doesn't recognize my enlightenment. He's ruined my calligraphy. I'm not standing this." And he demanded to be taken back to the abbot. And as the attendant was rowing him back, he never realized this was the first time he'd gone back to the monastery, left his island for 3 years. And he stormed into the abbot's office. He slammed these parchment down. "You've written these ugly words, you spoiled my poem, and you're rude. Saying fart is not a proper word for a monk to say. Explain yourself, abbot," he demanded. And the abbot was very calm. He slowly unrolled the scroll. He stood up. He looked at the monk, and then he read the words. "The diligent monk," said the abbot, "meditating alone for 3 years, is no longer moved, it says here, by the four worldly winds. Yet, young monk," he said, looking at this monk, "four little farts have blown you clean across the lake." You're no longer moved by the four worldly winds, yet four farts have blown you right over the lake. At which the young monk realised, "Oh no, I'm not enlightened after all." So he went back into the boat, went back to the island and meditated for a few more years. It's a classic story of how you test out if someone's enlightened. If you get angry, you're not enlightened. If you have lust, not enlightened. So that's how we test out what happens. But what actually happens, you get this huge experiences, you do feel enlightened for a few days. You have to wait to see what defilements come back. If after a while you find out, yeah, you really have penetrated non-self, it means straight away that there's something about the Dharma of Buddhism you understand quite clearly. You understand why we get reborn and what keeps this whole process going. You understand craving, born of delusion, keeps you moving and traveling through this life and into your future lives. When I said the journey, we always keep journeying and journeying. Where are we leave going in our life? When you're young, you want to finish your schooling. When you're schooling, you want to get married. When you're married, you want your kids to grow up. When your kids are grown up, you want to retire. When you retire, you want to go to heaven. We're always wanting to go somewhere. How many of you have ever been really happy where you are? So content, you're just happy to be in this moment. So content, you can't even think. So content, you just have so much happiness and bliss in this moment. How many of you have truly stopped the journey of life? The only way to stop is to abandon craving for a few moments. Enough for the car, your vehicle, which is your life, to pause and to come to a stop. And to realize that that stop is nirvana. When you have seen non-self, you can stop more often in life, which means that you can meditate more easily. A stream winner has a much easier time of meditating. They're not so restless. They can let go more easily because they've seen non-self. They haven't got this hand which keeps picking up things so much. That's a stream winner. After that, the main cause of the cravings has been undermined. And it's only a matter of time before those cravings of desire and ill will. The stream winner still gets angry, the stream winner can still have lust and desire. But the very foundations of that lust and desire have been removed. It's only a matter of time. The desire and the lust get weaker and weaker over time. Soon they become a stream winner, soon they become an anagami. An anagami, a non-returner, it's very easy to see what an anagami is. Not only do they not get angry, they don't have lust. You can see the sort of desirelessness which they have. In the sutras, many lay people and lay women became non-returners. And it's fascinating to read their stories and what sort of people they were. I've already mentioned Gahikara. He was an anagami. He wouldn't even dig the earth in case he harmed any living beings. He would actually collect earth which was already dug so he could make his pots. Nor would he buy and sell. He would just put the pots on a bench with a sign, if you want a pot, please take one. If you want to leave some food, please leave it. And the only reason he wasn't a monk, he was celibate. The only reason he wasn't a monk was because of his blind parents. He had to look after them. There was a famous lay woman who was an anagami, a non-returner. And this is how much she had renounced and let go. I think I told a story earlier on, but it's a wonderful story. She was living at home. Some soldiers came, they suspected her son of doing some criminal act. They dragged him out of the house, questioned him very quickly, decided he was guilty, and murdered him on the spot, in front of his mother. And his mother, being an anagami, said, even though I saw my own son being executed in front of me, unfairly, he never did anything wrong. Never once did I have any anger towards those soldiers, nor any disappointment or grief over the loss and the death of my only son. That's how much detachment a non-returner has. So you can see how free they feel. No desire. This is almost unworldly, unusual. It's not a simple thing, but it's true. And the arahat, the only reason there's a difference between the non-returner and the arahat, the last attachment of the anagami is basically to the joy and the peace of the deep meditations, but also just a very, very fine lingering forgetfulness. Sometimes they think under the old habits that there's a being in there. But after a while even that goes. The distance between being a non-returner and a full arahat is so small. They are the four stages of enlightenment. And the four arahat, the enlightenment, they're so still, they're so at peace, they never get reborn again. There's no reason to get reborn again. The will, the choice, the craving, which is the cause of
for keeping on going is now finally being removed. Some people ask, well, what's the point of being an arahat then? The point is that once you're in that stage, from that selflessness, from that emptiness, that is where true compassion, true metta originates from. Real metta comes from emptiness. When there's a self in there, when you're trying to do it, anything, you're trying to get somewhere, it's never really full loving kindness, real compassion. Only the enlightened ones can be truly compassionate. So selfless because there's no self left in there. And they're fully non-judging, out there for the happiness and kindness of all other beings. And you can see that with like a monk like Ajahn Chah, who I lived with for 9 years. Because you were with him for such a long time, and as a Westerner you're always checking him out to see, what is this guy? Is he really enlightened or not? Has he got any anger? Sometimes people try and wind him up and try and make him angry. But never once in all those years did I see him get angry or upset. One occasion which really inspired me was one occasion he had his own little room, private room. No one was allowed to go up there. It was where he slept and meditated. One day, I'd been his disciple for many years, he asked me to go up to his room and fetch something. I was so excited. It was the first and only time I saw Ajahn Chah's own room, my master's quarters. At this time, Ajahn Chah was very, very famous in Thailand. Not only had he invitations to go and teach Dharma to the king and the queen of Thailand, many generals would come, and when they'd come they'd give him incredible gifts, all sorts of stuff, you know, like what people like to give monks. One of my problems, when I come even here, people keep giving me requisites in my room. I've got all these requisites now, I have to get rid of them before I go back. But this was Ajahn Chah, who was so famous, he'd got given heaps of things. So when I went into his room, I opened the door. You can imagine this, my inspiration, when I saw his room was empty. All there was in his room was a mat, like what I'm sitting on now, this one, these grass mats, a wooden pillow, and one robe on the line. Nothing else. No knick-knacks. No sort of tea or coffee or whatever. It was completely empty. When I saw that, I thought, that's a person with no desires. That's a person free of craving. Even though he had all the opportunity in the world to have expensive things, beds, lounges, recliners, TV sets, you name it, he could have it. He had nothing. That's a sign of an enlightened being. Someone who has so few possessions, because they have so few desires. Now you have some idea of what enlightenment is. And seeing a person like that was so inspiring for me as a young man. You hear all of these stories about enlightened beings, and some of them, they're so disappointing. They say they're enlightened, but they get angry. They say they're enlightened and they ask for donations. They say they're enlightened and they travel around in big cars. What, are they really enlightened or not? Have they really given up craving and desires? So when actually you see the real thing, it's just so inspiring. Yeah, it's possible in this day and age, and there are people who are arahats, fully enlightened. And that inspiration by itself is such a great gift to this world. You might say a bodhisattva, an enlightened bodhisattva can do something, but an enlightened arahat, they can encourage and inspire so much. And the teachings which come out of people like Ajahn Chah are just so profound. Little one-liners. It's not the sound disturbs you, it's you disturb the sound. That's worth staying with a master for 100 years to hear something like that. So that's what happens when you're a great enlightened being. The amount of help you can give the world, the true compassion coming from real wisdom is so powerful. You do so much for others. So if you really want to do something for the world, you really want to help and serve, the most powerful thing to do first of all is become an arahant, fully enlightened. And then your compassion is empowered, far more powerful than any bodhisattva. That's why it's always been the arahants, from the time of their enlightenment to the time of their final passing away, have been the people who have turned the wheel of the Dhamma. This was the Buddha's simile. At Bodh Gaya he found the Dhamma, at Benares he started turning the wheel of Dhamma. He turned it for 45 years, and in that time he created so many other arahants, both men and women. And since that time there's always been plenty of male and female fully enlightened beings to keep that wheel turning. When one person passes away into Parinibbana, there's many others they create in the meantime to carry on pushing that wheel, to keep the Dhamma alive. This is why the Dhamma is still alive and flourishing in your age. You're very fortunate to be born in this time where such teachings are still readily available. The purest Dhamma is there. And so you too can become enlightened and then spend some time before you completely disappear pushing that beautiful wheel of the Dhamma. This is what enlightenment is. The ending of all desires. Seeing emptiness of non-self. Being so free, so at peace, you don't need anything. You have an empty room where you sleep. You have an empty room in between your ears. Completely free. Always having space to talk to someone else, to be with them. Never getting irritated or angry. So if you want to test out any monk, try and call them an idiot. Try and wind them up. Try and get them upset. See if they get angry, then you know where they are. Also, the other time you know is when they are sick, when they're in pain. But sometimes when people are in pain, that's when you find out whether they're afraid. They're afraid of death. So, that's what enlightenment is. And this is how it works. It's a natural process. It will happen to you in good time. So don't worry about it. You're all going to get there in the end. Enjoy the journey, or rather, see if you can stop the journey. Just stop, and you'll find in that stopping, you'll have everything you ever want. So, that's the talk today about enlightenment. Now, I hope you understand what you're aiming for, or what you're going to get. If you don't want to become enlightened, I'd get out of here as soon as you possibly can. The longer you stay, the more likely it is it's going to happen. So, any questions about the talk on enlightenment?
Q&A time.
Yeah. So what happened? Sorry, what happened? Lay people were born in the time of Lord Buddha. people like are reborn in the time when there's no Dhamma, it's very unlikely that you get reborn in such a time. If any of you have actually practiced and done a lot of good meditation, you're just attracted to places where there's Dhamma. However, if you are, say, a stream winner who gets, a stream winner or a once returner who gets reborn at a time when there's no Buddha around, because you're a stream winner, it's interesting fact is, when you were born, you had an understanding of non-self in your previous life, but when you are born, you're just like an ordinary child. You can be naughty like any other child, except you'll be naturally good and naturally pure-hearted. And sometime in your life, you obviously naturally tend to keep five precepts. Sometime in your life, you'll have the same enlightened experience, the same feeling, the same feeling of non-self as you had in your previous life. You actually reattain the experience of feeling. You have to do that.
if you are once a turner and you get reborn in the time of this noble Buddha, then you have to see full enlightenment sometime in that life. If there's no Buddha around, there's no Dhamma around, then you're either going to be a Pacheka Buddha, in other words, a silent Buddha, someone fully enlightened but doesn't teach. Or, if you have like a friend, like Siddhartha Gautama did, who asks you, please teach, then you become a new Buddha. So, for example, Maitreya, the next Buddha, will be a Sakadagami, a once returner, who will come back at a time, once returner now, who will come back at a time when there's no Dhamma in this world. And because he's a once returner, will get reborn, attain enlightenment, someone will ask him to teach, he will teach, and we'll have our next Buddha. But only in the time when all Buddhism has disappeared. That's why that no one can be Maitreya Buddha now. You need to wait until Buddhism completely disappears. But as you've just been hearing the last 7 days, Buddhism hasn't disappeared at all. It's actually really 100% still here. This is amazing. Does that answer your question? And next question, anyone wish to ask? About enlightenment. I'll ask a question. Can people become enlightened in other religions? Anyone know the answer? Because that was a wonderful question which somebody asked the Buddha just before he entered Parinibbana, before he passed away. What an amazing question it is for our modern age. And in just as you would expect of a Buddha, he just gave us an amazing answer which went right to the heart of the question. What he said, in whatever religion, in whatever sect, in whatever practice or philosophy, you find the Eightfold Path being taught and being practiced, there you will find the four levels of enlightenment, the stream winner, the once returner, the non-returner, and arahant. What he was saying, it doesn't matter what you call the religion, it's what you're doing. The practice is important. And if you're practicing the Eightfold Path, doesn't matter what you call it, it always leads to those four stages of enlightenment. If you're not practicing the Eightfold Path, even if you call it Buddhism, you won't find any enlightened beings. The name is not important. What's important is what you're doing. The practice. This is all cause and effect. And what he meant also there, if any one of you follows the Eightfold Path and keeps on perfecting it, you can be absolutely sure sooner or later you too will be a stream winner, once returner, non-returner, or arahant, fully enlightened. It's a path which leads there. Doesn't matter what you aspire, if you aspire to put off your enlightenment, become a bodhisattva, or if you want to become enlightened, it doesn't matter. If you follow that path, that's where it leads. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. The precepts, the meditation, the jhanas, and the wisdom. This is what happens, cause and effect. So it doesn't really matter about you struggling or not struggling. As I've said to many of you, you're already on the aircraft, it's going to Nibbana. Many of you, they rush to the front, you put forth so much effort, think you're going to get there quicker. That is stupid. You get there anyway, you just let go and it just happens. Once you're on the aircraft, you can sit back and relax. Let the pilot do all the driving. The pilot's the Buddha. He's already automatic pilot once you get on the plane. It lands automatically in Nirvana. You don't have to worry about a thing. And again, that was one of my teacher, Ajahn Chah's sayings. In the first year, one of those sayings again, I never understood at the time. He said his monastery was like a mango orchard. He said all the trees have been planted by the Buddha. And the mangoes are already on the trees. You monks these days don't have to do anything except just put your hand out and the mango will fall.
Don't I need to do something? Don't I need to put forth effort? Don't I need at least to shake the mango tree? He said, no, don't do anything. Don't shake anything. Just put your hand out and the mango falls. That's all you need to do to get jhanas. Just put your hand out and be still. Don't move it. Don't shake anything. And jhanas fall right into your hand. That's how you become enlightened. Stop doing things. Stop shaking the mango tree. It's already been planted by the Buddha, by the Arahants. You don't have to do anything. Understand? If you don't understand, I give my final simile. This is one of my favorites. So this really is an original. This is not in the suttas. Was not sent by the Buddha. But I really like this simile because it shows you what enlightenment is and how it happens. It's a simile of the donkey and the carrot. Remember that simile? It's a really nice one. The donkey and the carrot. For those of you who haven't heard this simile, it goes like this. In southern Europe, before the advent, before the internal combustion engine, the villagers would always use donkey carts to carry their produce and to carry people. They put all of their fruit and vegetables in the donkey cart, or they climb in the back of the cart, and the donkey would pull them from town to town, village to village. However, you may understand that donkeys have a reputation for being very stubborn. If you try and hit them with a stick, they will not go. The only way you can make a donkey move, the only way you can get it to pull a cart, is actually to tie a stick to its back with the end of the stick about 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. On the end of that stick is a string. On the end of a string is a fat, juicy carrot, which is now about 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. So the donkey sees this very juicy carrot right in front of it, and so moves forward to eat the carrot. As he moves forward, so does a stick, so does a string, so does a carrot. So it doesn't matter how far forward the donkey goes, the carrot goes the same distance at the same speed, and at the same time the donkey pulls the cart behind it. That's how they get the donkey to pull the cart. Craving for the carrot. It wants it, keeps going, but the carrot keeps going further and further away from it. Doesn't matter how fast the donkey goes, the carrot goes at the same speed. So that's how they used to get the donkeys to pull the carts, with a little carrot. However, about 30 years ago, 40 years ago, Buddhism came to southern Europe, and all the donkeys learned how to catch the carrot, so they can't use donkey carts anymore, they have to use petrol engines. And now I will tell you how the donkey catches the carrot. And this is a simile for how you become enlightened. How does a donkey catch the carrot? Even if it runs, the carrot goes the same speed in front of it, but the donkey, because of meditation, because it's been listening to some of Ajahn Brahm tapes or cassettes, the donkey now learns how to stop, how to let go, how to do nothing. So what the donkey does, the donkey runs like hell after that carrot. Runs as hard as it's ever done after that carrot. He knows. No matter how fast it runs, the carrot goes the same speed in front of it. But now, running at top speed, the donkey stops. This is what it learns from Buddhism, how to stop. When it stops, the carrot goes further away. Like many of you, when you stop trying, sometimes the mind gets restless, you start thinking about all sorts of things, and you complain to me, you say, look, if I let go, I keep thinking about anything. I said, yes, carry on stopping. The mind will come back to you after a while. And this is what happens with the carrot. As soon as the donkey stops, the carrot goes further away. In fact, that carrot goes further away from the donkey than it's ever been in the whole donkey's life. Sometimes when you're meditating, you feel you're going crazy. Even more crazy, more restless than you are in normal daily life. Isn't that so? Be patient. Because that carrot goes as far as it's ever been. And then something strange happens. it stops and it starts coming towards you. The carrot starts moving towards the donkey. You're just sitting here and all these wonderful stages of meditation start coming to you. You don't do anything. The carrot comes to you. In a little while, the carrot is at its normal distance, 2 feet in front of you. But this time, it's coming at great speed towards you. And it gets closer and closer. You don't do anything. Except just at the right moment, you say to the carrot, "The door of my mouth is open to you." Come in. And the carrot comes into the donkey's mouth. That's how donkeys catch carrots. That's how you become enlightened. That's how you get jhanas. You've already been running hard enough in your life. In this meditation for you to stop. When you first stop, sure enough, things go further away from you. You think you're going crazy, you're restless, you're sleepy, sloth and torpor, all these thoughts. That's part of the course. That will happen. Don't do anything. Don't try. Don't start running again. Keep absolutely still. Have some faith. Be patient. Don't do anything. Don't even move. In a little while, the carrot starts coming towards you. You see all these beautiful states of mind. Present moment awareness. The mind gets so silent, so easy. Silence comes to you. The breath, and the breath is just there. This beautiful breath going in and out. You don't have any effort at all to watch it. It's just there for you. The carrot's coming closer. And then you get these beautiful nimittas coming up. You don't do it. You don't try and hold them or make it happen. Nimittas, these beautiful lights come into your mind. And then the jhanas come. You don't make them happen. You just let go and the jhanas come to you. And just at the right moment, the carrot's so close to you, like the jhana is so close, the right moment, you draw my mouth open. Enlightenment. Enlightenment comes to you. You don't chase enlightenment. Now, if you understand that simile, you understand how you should have been meditating all the last few days. Fortunately, you've got 1 day left to get it right. So, please, tomorrow, stop. Don't go running after anything. To see how still you can be, and the stiller you are, the more chance the carrot of enlightenment will come in. And you're just sitting there, thank you, enlightened. And you go home and have your meditator. The donkey and the carrot simile, one of my favourites. You had a question? Yeah, go on. Yeah. Remember, that was only a movie. Yeah. It's okay, very good. Any other question you have there? Yes, in the back. Is Arahant a fully enlightened Buddha? A Buddha is an arahat, but an arahat's not always a Buddha. What I mean that, if you get the full enlightenment, and there's already the Buddha's teachings around, then you're called an arahat. If there's not the Buddha's teachings around, and you start the teachings, you're called a Buddha. So like a Buddha is only like the first arahat in the sequence. Everyone who comes afterwards is just called arahat. So like Buddha is the first. That's the only difference. Even the Buddha said that, the attainments are the same.
as far as the tables are concerned, but the Buddha just came first. Any other questions anyone has about enlightenment? It's a very rare opportunity. Go on. You're asking, are there many arahats around these days? It's not enough. We need some more. It's never enough. Can women become fully enlightened? Is it more likely as a woman or as a man to become fully enlightened? Exactly the same. Because it's not the body which comes to mind. It's your body makes you a woman or a man, but your mind is beyond gender. And it's your mind which becomes in mind. So it doesn't really matter your gender at all. Male or female is a man. The mind is beyond gender. So that doesn't matter at all. Yeah. Okay, you're asking if the mind has been going a long time, why can't we teach a child? Very often, actually, children, especially when they're very young, before they get, you know, corrupted by our schools and by our culture, you know, by all the stuff which you teach them, sometimes that some children are incredibly pure. There's all these amazing stories. I told someone here somewhere about this disciple in Perth. She really got shocked when she was feeding her baby, only about a few weeks old, maybe a few days old, I forget now. And you know, this sort of, you know, the mother was lying on the bed and the baby was on her chest. She was on her back, the baby was on top. The little baby sat up on her chest, crossed his legs in full lotus, put his hands in his palms and started meditating. And that's a true story. This little 2 or 3 weeks old baby's got in a meditation posture. Closed its eyes and for all intents and purposes and the baby meditating. And I wonder, where did he get that idea from? It's obviously it was a meditator from a past life, got reborn into her family. And, you know, just spontaneously. This little baby, a couple of weeks old, couldn't even speak yet, started meditating. Incredible. So what usually happens though is it's after a while we tend to forget. The first few weeks of our life, sometimes we can recall our previous life. It's a continuity, it was only very recently. But then after a while we forget, and we get influenced by our environment, much more so than from our past. And after a while we can very much lose the tendencies which we came into this life with, and they get replaced with the tendencies of our current life. The classic story of this man who was born in Burma. And when he was a young boy, he refused to take rice and curry. He always wanted bread and butter and cups of tea. And of course, the people found out his past life. He was, in his past life, a British soldier who died in Burma during the Second World War and got reborn in the womb of a Burmese girl. So his body was Burmese, but, you know, his inclinations were very British. And he liked, he just wanted bread and butter and cups of tea. That's what he wanted. But when he got to puberty, around that age, he lost contact with his previous life and he turned into a real Burmese. He just liked rice and greasy curries. And that's all. And it's common that around that time, 13 or 14, you actually change. You lose contact with your past. It's just too far away. And you adopt the culture of where you are now. In most cases. Sometimes all happens. Like the Buddha when he was born under the rose apple tree, he managed to sit under there and get into a jhana. How could he do that? It's because of his training under Kassapa the Buddha in the previous life. He could still remember that, even maybe only subconsciously, how to meditate. But later on he forgot all about that. In puberty and growing up, just became like an ordinary prince, maybe a special one, but you know, just the same desires like everybody else. Yeah. No. No, not really, because but later on in life you have a chance to get further, to advance further. You're not really that pure, it's almost like a stupidity. It's only those children who have really done something in their previous life. Most children are just like ordinary children, they're naughty. You've had children before. You know, no, they're naughty, they're not pure at all. They're fine, they're jealous. But the point is that when they grow to maturity, they have the opportunity to actually to grow and to become, you know, meditators, keep precepts. And you can do so much in the years of your maturity to advance on the spiritual path. Otherwise, if a child, they've advanced in the previous life and they die when they're young, they just take with them what they've already attained. They don't get any further. So that's why they do say, that's very true, the human life is very special and precious. You can make more progress on the path of enlightenment in this life than any other life. So it is precious. You're very fortunate to have a human life here in Malaysia at this particular time. So you had a lot of good karma to get this far. So don't waste it. Yeah? Sentient beings in lower realms. Like, it's incredible that you see that little dog who comes to breakfast. You see how he comes when they offer the table in the morning? And this morning I saw him there as you're offering the table, he's wagging his stumpy tail ferociously. That little dog was actually celebrating, was rejoicing in the offering of the food this morning to a monk. That dog this morning made good karma. And sometimes the animals, sometimes, I don't know why they do this, the fact that a dog has found a home in a temple means, as far as the dogs are concerned, that's one of the highest dogs. It's amazing. Now, the dog karma, he's close to the top, because being in a temple, he's very likely to be reborn as a human being. And sometimes this beautiful story about the elephant and the monkey. One of my favorite stories, it's so sweet. After an argument amongst the monks, I'll tell you the full story because I like telling this, because it shows you what power you have over the monks and nuns, and you should practice this power. In the town of Kasambi, the monks had an argument. It was a stupid argument over a small thing, but nevertheless, the argument got out of hand. There were two big factions, they were arguing, they weren't talking with each other. So the Buddha came to settle the argument. When he came, when people get into arguments, they forget completely what's right and what's wrong. So the monks came up and said, "No, Buddha, you go off and meditate. Leave this to us." They were actually rude to their teacher. And the teacher thought, these monks are just so crazy with their argument, they won't even listen to me. So the Buddha left them and went off into the forest. When the people, the lay people, they saw the Buddha had arrived but immediately left because he was upset at the monks, which meant that the lay people couldn't hear any teachings from the Buddha, also got very dispirited with the monks. Had a big meeting. These monks are getting out of hand. The Buddha came here because of these guys, these monks, the Buddha left and he couldn't give us any teachings at all. This is really unfair. We've got to sort this out. So they had a meeting. And they decided they would give no food at all to any monk. Now, as you know, the monks cannot survive if you don't give them food. So for 6 days, the monks went on alms round. They got absolutely nothing. No one brought any dana to the monasteries, not even any cheese or chocolate. Even if they did have them, they didn't get them in those days. They got nothing. And after 6 days of not eating, the monks get very hungry. And that brought them to their senses.
they realized that they were being stupid by having this argument, so they met together and they forgave each other and they decided to live in harmony, forgetting the stupid thing they had an argument about and just forgiving each other. And sometimes if you see monks misbehaving, if you see me misbehaving, don't feed me. After a while I come to my senses, I realize I must be doing something wrong. No one's bringing dana. So please do that, because that's the power which you have to help safeguard the Sangha of monks and nuns. But anyway, the Buddha went off into this forest for the rain retreat to stay alone. And it was an elephant fed the Buddha every day. The elephant would find food like yams or fruit in the forest and come and offer it to the Buddha. That's how the Buddha survived for 3 months. So imagine the merit, the good karma this elephant made. He had an enlightened being, a Buddha, all to himself for 3 months. Just giving food one day to a Buddha is huge good karma. This elephant had 3 months, the Buddha all to himself. But actually not always, because one day this little monkey, he was swinging through the trees and he saw this elephant giving food to the Buddha. And the monkey thought, wow, this is really something. I want to do this as well. So this monkey swang through the trees and found a honeycomb. Swang pretty quickly to get it and to take it away before the bee stung him. And swang all the way to the Buddha and went down and offered honey to the Buddha. And the Buddha accepted the honey from this little monkey. And the amount of good karma which that monkey received for offering honey, the monkey just got so much happiness. This is that word many of you ask me, pity. There's incredible joy. I'd just given honey to an enlightened Buddha. And he was swinging through the trees in euphoria when he missed a branch and fell down and died. He was just died of happiness. And of course this monkey, because of his happiness, got reborn as a David in the Tower Tingsaro. Because if you die with that much happiness, incredible good karma, that's what happens to you. And as for the elephant, after a while, once the monks reconciled, it was Ananda who led a group of monks to try and find the Buddha, to try and get him to come back and teach, saying this problem's been sorted out, we apologize for being rude to you, please come back and teach us. And they found the Buddha in this forest. And the elephant was so delighted to see not just one monk, but many monks. And so the elephant just spent all day getting food for all the monks. But then the Buddha said to the elephant, "Elephant, now I have to go back to the human beings. I have to go back and teach the Sangha, to teach the lay community. So I'll now be leaving." And this poor elephant was so sad. As soon as the Buddha walked away, the elephant died of a broken heart. As you would, if you've been looking after a Buddha for 3 months, then the Buddha disappeared. Oh, you felt so sad. And so the elephant died of a broken heart. But because of all the good karma of serving a Buddha for 3 months, he got reborn in even a higher realm than a monkey, in the Tusita realm. So that's how animals can make good karma. Little dog wagging its tail when the table is offered to a monk. If that little dog had died at that point, he would have probably gone to some heaven realm. Isn't that nice? So I always like that story of the elephant and the monkey, because it's so sweet. It is a beautiful story about karma and beauty and goodness and the happiness you get. Like I said the other night, when I got one of Ajahn Chah's toes and washed it, I was like that monkey, I was euphoric. I'm actually washing a toe of my teacher. Oh, it's so nice. Okay. Any other? One, two questions and we've got to finish off. That's the last question. One, and then two. Yeah? Hi. Okay, I think I mentioned that yesterday or the day before. The Buddha's, or the Bodhisattva, the Buddha to be, when he was practicing under Alarika Lama Uttaka Ramaputta, He was almost certain that what he was actually doing was not the real thing of nothingness or non-perception or non-perception, because it wasn't based on jhanas. So it would be sort of a not the real thing, a false copy of those things. So he would have been doing the real attainment of nothingness, or the real attainment of non-perception or non-perception under those two teachings. In the same way, as I mentioned yesterday, you can get a degree from university just by paying money. But it's not the real degree, even though it says it's got the same name. Okay, your question? Can an arahat commit suicide? Yeah, they can commit suicide. Did the Buddha commit suicide? How did the Buddha die? Some people say he died because he ate pork or something from Chunda the smith a few months before his Parinibbana. But other people say that earlier than that, 3 months before his Parinibbana, at the Chavala shrine, Vaisali, with Ananda listening, the Buddha gave all these clues to say if he wanted to, he can carry on his life till the end of the eon. Ananda didn't take the hint, and so after Ananda left, the Buddha intentionally, mindfully abandoned the life faculty, and thereby determined in 3 months he would pass into Parinibbana. Is that suicide? The Buddha intentionally ended his life. I say that to stir people up. What is suicide anyway? But the arahats, I better finish off quickly. Many arahats, when they die, like Ananda, like Dhamma Mataputta was another one who did this. When Ananda passed away, it was supposed to be, according to the commentaries, it's quite likely, 40 years after the Buddha's Parinibbana, Ananda passed away, fully in life, another arahat. By this time, he was the most famous monk in the whole of India, and being the most famous monk, had lots of people worshipping him. And by that time, people knew that if they got Ananda's relics in their city, they'd have lots of pilgrims coming to worship. So these two big kingdoms were competing after Ananda's relics. They both wanted him to die in their kingdom. And they was going to go to war over this. Please die in my kingdom. It's like, you know, a famous monk is about to die. Please die in Ipoh. No, no, come to KL first of all. No, no, do it in Penang, because then we can put a stupa in Penang. They'd want to come and worship in our stupa. That's what it was like. And so Ananda, he walked to the boundary between these two kingdoms, to the river. One of the kingdoms said, stay on this side, this is our territory. The other one said, go on the other side, it's nicer over there. But that was the time when Ananda decided to enter Parinibbana, to pass away. He rose up into the air, levitated, positioned himself right in the center of the river, right between the two kingdoms, and then he entered what's called a fire element. Fire engulfed his body, he burned to a cinder, and the two piles of ashes fell on either side of the river, an equal pile. And that's the story. There's something very interesting in Greek history. I've always wanted to find someone who knew ancient Greek to check this out. Because according to Greek history, maybe 100 or 200 years after the time of the Buddha, an Indian monk immolated himself in the Forum of Athens and caused a sensation. His name was Kalanos, what these days we call Kalyana. Was that another case recorded in the Western tradition in Greek of a monk who rose into the air and immolated himself just like Ananda? Certainly Buddhist monks were there in Athens at the time. Was that one of them? Fully enlightened being who also ends the Parinibbana in a time-honored fashion, rising up into the air, entering the fire element and immolating themselves. With that, I will end this evening's talk.
So let's share merits before we go. So we're sharing merits with our departed relations. Idam me yatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me yatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me yatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Tomorrow night we come down to earth again with metta in everyday life, how we can use these teachings in our business, in our career, in our homes, in our hospitals. Metta, how we use these teachings in everyday life. So tomorrow we come down a few rungs of the ladder. So that's tomorrow night's talk, the final talk in the series of talks on the meditation retreat. See you all tomorrow. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.